Yes. And now let me invite Elling Schoeneland from Christian Mikkel Institute to give your remarks, and maybe we'll come back to more questions and answers after Elling and Harris. Please, Elling.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed very much reading this paper. It's true, it's you have ambitious goals and you ask the big questions, but sometimes we have to stop up and reflect and ask those big questions. And I'm grateful for you to having brought some of the big themes from the scholarly debate about regionalism into the into the arena. Your paper comes across as very critical of the Swedish strategy, at least the old Swedish strategy. I haven't read the new strategy. I haven't read internal reviews and so on of the previous strategy. So my knowledge of that is part of the strategy is partly based on the very old days and on your paper. A key message from you is the accusation or the statement that there is an overemphasis on intergovernmental support to intergovernmental organizations. What I did was to look at your paper and to look at the quantitative data that you provided, and I simply followed the money. And by looking at the money flows, the striking thing for me was that there is so little money going to the RECs and to the AUs. Most of the money is actually going to other organizations, to channels outside, including research, including NGOs, think tanks, and so on. So I would perhaps thought that that would require some more reflections, and especially since you also say that there is so much we don't know about the impact of support to regional organizations. That calls for some critical questions and reflections around quite significant amount of money that's been put into research and NGOs and think tanks. I'll come back to some of those issues later. As I said, I read the report with interest when I first read it. I now, yesterday, reread the report, focusing on your 10 final recommendations. And what struck me with those recommendations is that most of them could have been applied to any development aid interventions. There is a confusion about means and ends. There is too much focus on activities and outputs. There is too limited understanding of the context and so on. All of that is true. But it's also something that applies to a lot of the other aid intervention. So then I decided, let me also read the other two reports that we've discussed today and say what sort of findings and recommendations are coming out of that. And can we use that to apply that to some of the our observations around lessons learned from support to regional cooperation. So that's what I've been doing. And my point of departure is something you, an important message that you have in the report on page 50, primarily, but also strongly made in the recommendations, stronger than you did in the report. And that is that the Swedish support to regional cooperation is important because it's relevant, because a lot of the problems that Africa is facing are transboundary challenges. They can best be addressed at the regional level. And that, I think, is a very important point of departure. The first big question I would like to ask is that in the Swedish strategy for regional cooperation, more emphasis should be given to what the Uganda paper calls policy and program development, what we could call conceptualization. What is the problem that we want to solve or contribute to a solution to? And when we asked that and found answers to that, we can move into the next step. Next question is, let's design our aid intervention. What sort of intervention do we want to launch? What are the planned activities, outputs, eventual outcomes and incomes? What's the level of funding? What are the channels that we want to use to achieve this? And for me, the key message around conceptualization is that we have to ask the questions, what problems do we want to address? And we want to address challenges that cannot be sufficiently addressed at a national level. And that applies to all the three areas that that's been singled out, right? Peace and security, environmental issues, economic integrations. And there are a range of areas where one can intervene there or support. It can be intergovernmental organizations, regional bodies. It can be support activities involving two or more countries. It can even be supporting the regional work of one country. For example, one country might have strong NGOs, strong training facilities, institutions that can be used also by other countries. It can be support by regional bodies and organizations to do work in one country, whether it be South Sudan or Somalia, for example. Or it can simply be facilitate information sharing, lessons learned between countries in the region. And based on this, I think I make four or five issues. They are all, to some extent, more or less addressed in your paper, but I would like to take them a little bit further. First, your critical comments about intergovernmental organizations, whether it be the AU, the RECs, or even other intergovernmental organizations. I think you're very correct, and it's important that you've done what you've done in pointing out that the fact that they are poor in delivering and is a cause of much frustration for anybody who wants to support them is that it's not just about technical deficiencies of those organizations. The reasons for their often, not always, but often poor performance has to do with politics. And therefore, it's simply something which often cannot be addressed solely by focusing on capacity building. But I think it's important here to draw in, I think it's a Tanzania paper, which introduced the distinction between higher and lower levels of ownership. That higher level of ownership is important. But that is not sufficient. Implementation capacity is a bottleneck. And it cannot be neglected. And there are many easy ways out. The easiest way is to, in certain areas, which some donors do, is to create solely donor-managed implementation agencies. And you can deliver on activities and outputs as planned, I almost said. You can do civil society support. You can work supporting the private sector, business sector, and so on. And all of those actors can be important. And as you mentioned in your introduction, HIV/AIDS work in Southern Africa, for example, which has been supporting, received important support from Sweden, they have done important work at the both at the national level, and they have benefited from working together at the regional level. And I would also add, it's one of the few cases where it's also had an impact upon the work of an intergovernmental organization. It's one of the few areas, I think the only one, there could be others, but I don't know, where actually civil society has been able to second officials to the secretariat of an intergovernmental organization to work on HIV/AIDS. But you have to think carefully about what you want to achieve. There are limits to what a civil society network or the private sector can do. They can be important in advocacy, they can be important in implementation, pursuing things at the national level, or also working together, but they can't replace intergovernmental organizations. Secondly, alignment issues. You have important points about national and the need for alignment between national strategies and regional strategies. Applies to donors as well as to African organizations and countries. I would like to add one other dimension to alignment, and that is the importance of alignment between the AU and what's happening further down at the RECs. The AU may be seen as a mother body, but it's not really recognized as a mother body by the RECs. And there are some different donor experiences in how to work both in relations to RECs and to the AU. I think Germany, for example, has been doing important work there on the peace and security sector. Then the issue of coherence of a regional strategy. I think that it's difficult to talk about one regional strategy in the sense that everything contributes, all interventions contribute to the same objectives, because we are talking about different sectors, we are talking about different regions. So perhaps we need to narrow to operate with different subsets here. Finally, I'd like to draw the attention also to a message from the Tanzania country case study, which is the importance of dialogue. Supporting regional cooperation is not just about transferring bags of money. It's also about advocacy. It's also about engaging in a political dialogue with your partners. And one of the strengths of donor like Sweden has been in its ability to not just to be flexible and respond too quickly to developments on the ground and in Africa, but also to engage and be committed in the long term. And that is one of the important lessons from Tanzania. And I think those are important lessons also for support to regional cooperation. We just don't need a donor that is a manager of the transfer of funds. We need a donor that can nurture relationships, take risks, and be prepared to engage with the partners. Thank you.
Thank you, Erling. And next, may I invite Harry Hagen, who is the Senior Economic Advisor, Africa Division at the Department for International Development in UK. Please.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the invitation to discuss this paper. As with Erling, I thought it was a very interesting and thought-provoking report. I think he's had more engagement with it as it's developed, and I read it on Sunday, but it stopped me watching the football, so it must have had something good going for it. So some of the challenges set out here in the Swedish context are very familiar to us, so I recognise many of the issues that are raised, and I think what this paper is helpful, it allows us to step back a bit, or me to step back a bit from some of the detail, and consider things that I do in my day job and think, well, why am I doing this? Why am I getting up every day and working on these projects, and what's the context for that? And I think someone said this morning that bureaucracies tend to look in on themselves a lot, and I find a lot of what we do at the moment is deal with ourselves and our own governments and not talk so much to partners, either in other donor partners or partners in Africa as well. So it's very useful for me to consider this wider context of why am I doing what I'm doing in a wider setting. So just to say a little bit about myself, my main role in DFID at the moment is working on the economic development side of our regional support in Africa. So I think that's broadly similar to one of the three pillars on the Swedish side on economic integration. And maybe my remarks might reflect that side of things a bit more than some of the other sides on peace building or whatever, which I have a bit less knowledge of. Another distinction I think is useful to make is what do we mean when we talk about regional projects and regional programs? And I guess in the department I work in, we're really talking about three different types of programs. So some are in fact sub-regional, so they're in sub-regions within Africa, in East Africa, West Africa, and so on. Some are very much pan-African. The support to the EU is an example of that, or something like the African Enterprise Challenge Fund, which I think Sweden also supports, as an example of a pan-African initiative. And some of what we call regional is in fact just multi-country, and we do it regionally for economies of scale reasons or because there are sensitivities to doing things nationally. And I think a program we have on unsafe abortion, for example, is something that we like to do regionally rather than focus at the country level for sensitivity reasons. I assume in this context we're really talking about either pan-African or sub-regional projects. To go to some of what Frederick said about support to the RECs and how to position that, we have, I think, similar experience to some of the challenges he put up about working with the RECs. And currently we no longer have much direct support financially going to the RECs. There is still some, but it's very limited. And that's mainly because the experience has been a little difficult. And I guess there's a spectrum of how difficult that experience was and where our relationships are. I won't tell you the one end of the spectrum. I think the East African community is at the better end of the spectrum for us. We do still provide support to the African Union, and I think most observers would say that the African Union is an organisation that is developing, is doing some very good work in certain areas, is politically very important. And I think it would be inconceivable for us not at this point to be supporting the African Union. In terms of support to the RECs, that's perhaps less of a political imperative, and it's something perhaps we as a bilateral donor can choose to do or not to do. It's also easier to make that choice when an organisation like the EU is actually a big funder of the RECs, and so we know they're funding the RECs, and perhaps we don't have to do it because partly it's our money through the regional indicative programmes anyway. So we have some flexibility. But if no one were supporting the RECs, I think the decision whether to fund them or not would become a bit more problematic. Taking the issue of working less with RECs and government bodies and more with, for example, the private sector, and Frederick raised TMEA as one approach to do that. Again, an institution which Sweden actually supports. And in some ways you could say that TMEA came about because there wasn't a big implementation arm of the EAC. So it works under the patronage of the EAC. And the EAC was until recently part of its governance structure, actually more recently is not part of its governance structure. But had the EAC not allowed TMEA to develop, it would never have existed in the way it has. Another interesting thing about TMEA at the moment is that the board of TMEA has donor representatives on it, but it also has representatives from the private sector in East Africa, and the chair is actually a representative from the private sector. Another example we have of working not with the RECs is in our food trade work, which is essentially about trying to foster more trading of staple foods across borders within Africa, and it works in East Africa, Southern Africa, and we have a program also in West Africa, which is a bit newer. And I think there we are trying to work with private sector companies and private sector bodies such as East African Grain Council to put pressure on governments to remove the barriers to trading staple foods. And the pressure that those projects are bringing to bear is on national governments. It's not on the RECs, really, although the RECs have some involvement in some of the regulations and so on. But the power in this area lies with national governments. The paper talks about the need to have country buy-in to to regional approaches, and you can think of that in a number of ways. One way to think about it is obviously of the countries within the regions where the regional support is happening. And I think that's very true. And one of the examples, I think, again, from TMEA, is that there are national programs sitting alongside the regional element of it. And that's seen as a very important part of the success of it. And in fact, another way you can think about it is more bureaucratically within our own organisation. So the support of our own national programmes in those countries for that regional approach is also very necessary to keep it going within our own organisation. And for the next phase of it, in fact, the money for the national parts of TMEA will far outweigh the money for the regional parts of it. So the regional part is in some ways a froth on the top of national success. But there's good and bad experience here. So some of our work, I think, as regional work, does not find favour with the national programmes. This is more a domestic CEDA DFID thing, that the relationship between what works at country level and how these regional programmes fit in with what works at country level can be quite difficult to choreograph within our own organisations. The report picks up on the importance of political economy, and I think is very right to do so. Much of the work we do regionally could not happen without some sound understanding of the political economy behind it, and even when it has that understanding, it is still difficult to make it work because there's sometimes very little you can do about it. Particularly in trade work, for example, there are winners and losers. On the food trade example, if you're talking about trading maize within East Africa, Kenya is a deficit country, Uganda and Tanzania are surplus countries. Kenya imports from countries that are not in the region. Isn't there a win there if they work regionally and the surplus countries export to the deficit country? On the face of it, yes. There are many reasons why it's difficult to make that happen. And understanding what those reasons are and what the motivations are behind the barriers that exist is very important. And even if you do understand them, it's still not clear you're going to be able to do anything about it ultimately. So another point raised in the report is one about ownership versus effectiveness. And I think there are some real trade-offs there, and TMEA again was raised in as an example there. Let me give you another example from regional infrastructure, where as an organisation we've supported as a member state and with extra funds the EU Infrastructure Trust Fund, which supports project preparation for regional infrastructure. We've also supported the NEPAD AU African Development Bank run infrastructure project preparation facility, which also supports project preparation for regional infrastructure, although one is mainly, the IPPF is mainly public sector, the other one is mainly private sector. And it's very clear what has been most effective. The EU trust fund has worked much better and has very good results. There's an evaluation of it which is very positive. And the IPPF, although it's doing the right things, has a lot of political buy-in, has just not worked. And it has all the ownership going for it. There's no problem with ownership, but the implementation hasn't happened. So ownership is very important, but we also have to look at effectiveness. And if we go with the ownership as a guiding principle, I guess the conclusion will be that everything will take much longer. And you may want to look at solutions like TME, which sort of short-circuit that. That doesn't necessarily lead you to a sustainable institutional position, but it does get things done in the short term. Which brings me to imposing agendas from outside. There's some quite interesting stuff in the report about our donors supporting these regional bodies for their own reasons. And I guess the true answer to the question is it's not completely altruistic and it's not completely for their own reasons. It's somewhere in the middle, and that varies over time. But this regional assistance, certainly from our case, wouldn't happen if it was purely for our own agenda. I think that's pretty clear. That doesn't mean there's no narrow country interest in what we're doing, but it's not purely for external interest. Which brings me on to another point, which I think is very problematic in doing regional work, is do the external actors actually want the integration more than those in the region? So let me not talk about Africa in this context, and let me talk about the Caribbean, where I headed up our regional programme in the Caribbean for several years. And any time you got into a room and discussed regional integration in the Caribbean, the people who were not from the Caribbean were all saying, yeah, there's no issue here. It's clear you guys have got to integrate. You've got to work together more to do this. Whereas the Caribbean people were saying, well, I'm not so sure about this. Even though they had signed up to many agreements that said they were going to integrate economically, they still weren't really quite so sure about it. So there is a worry that you're trying to do things to regions that either don't want to do them or say they want to do them but don't really want to do them. Which is one of the reasons why much of our work is focused in East Africa, because I think in the East African community there is some real progress going on. The countries do want to do certain things, particularly on the trade side and on the transit side. If you compare that to West Africa, it's not very clear that the same political dynamic exists, and it can't be imposed from outside. So we had a programme that started at the same time as the TMEA in East Africa, in West Africa, and it achieved virtually nothing. Another interesting concept picked up in the paper was this one of symbolic regionalism, which was a new term to me, but I recognised what it meant. For those of you who hadn't read the paper, I don't claim to understand it fully, but I think it's basically the concept of countries wanting to go and sign up to African unity or regional unity, making big declarations, but really having no intention of implementing them ultimately. And I think there is an element of that going on, certainly in some of the work we do with trade agreements. So as the UK, we spent a lot of money supporting the tripartite free trade agreement. And there's also a mooted continental free trade agreement which builds on the tripartite. But the tripartite, although it was signed to with a bit of fanfare quite recently, is in fact not a trade agreement that takes a continent very much further forward in economic terms. And is very unlikely to be implemented. There are a lot of agreements signed, trade agreements signed within Africa, which are not being implemented, but it's still very popular for more of these agreements to be added and for leaders to be seen to be signing these agreements. So I think that concept does exist, but I don't think it's prevalent in every piece of regional agreement that happens in Africa. And certainly some of the work of the regional organisations is much more than the symbolic regionalism. I would say some, Elling, I think, related, talked about some of the peace and security work, which I think is having an impact and is regionally based and is much more than symbolism. Coming back to what we should or shouldn't do as donors, maybe we do need to walk away more often, particularly where we're finding we are trying to do things that aren't necessarily wanted. An example we have on that is trying to find something useful to do in the energy market in East Africa or more broadly in Africa. And we spent about a year and a half searching for some useful things to do and have found that we don't really have an entry point and that the institutions that exist, we don't really think we can support effectively. So we're not going to do that. There is an emphasis on more monitoring and evaluation, I think, in the report. I probably shouldn't say this in this audience, but I think evaluations are a bit of a problem in this area. There is a reason why there isn't very much evidence, and it's because it's difficult to get that evidence. The programmes regionally tend to be very complex, and the evaluation questions we're seeking to have answered sometimes may not be answerable. I've talked a bit about TMEA, but let me give another TMEA point. So there is an independent evaluation of TMEA, which we are funding, as it happens, and it's taken 2.5 years to get to the inception phase. So we're now about to consider a big new slug of money for the second phase of TMEA, and the evaluation of the first phase hasn't even started. Is that because we're asking the wrong questions? Is it because the program's so complex? It's easy to... I mean, the reason I run a portfolio that have many evaluations attached to them, and they all have problems. The reason we have the evaluations is when the programs were approved, we said there isn't very much evidence on whether this works or not, but we'll find the evidence with an evaluation of whether it works or not. So we have all these evaluations, but it's not clear that they will actually provide us with the evidence we're seeking. Yes, sorry, I haven't been looking at the person who's been holding up the cards. Two very short points. I agree with Elling. I think the tone seems a bit harsh in places on CEDA, and by implication on ourselves, actually. So yes, let's try to do better, but we're not working on an easy set of issues. They all take a very long time and no one has all the answers. And finally, I think there's a suggestion that Sweden should pick up on donor coordination in this area. We just had a session before lunch saying that donor coordination, you often really need a strong government to lead it or a strong institution to lead it, which we don't really have here. But I think we would be very happy for Sweden to take a lead on more discussions and more coordination. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Harriet.